maps for the record. It's 150. With us today, we have as a guest Representative Olson, Representative Kelly, Representative Weirach, Representative Jewell, Representative Katuma, Vice Chair Stoltz, Co-Chair Meyer, and myself, Co-Chair Chenault. This afternoon, and as other members become available, I'll try to announce them whenever they're here for the record. This afternoon on the schedule, we have the more independent businesses in the state that are dealing with Senate Bill 305. We plan to take testimony from the small producers and the explorers, starting with Mr. John Zager with Chevron Alaska. He's the general manager. We'd like to have you limit your comments in part to SB 305, and if you have comments on the changes between SB 305 and 488, we would be interested in hearing those. And probably I'd assume that committee members may have questions on the actual effect that it has on the smaller producers and the explorers. So with that, John, if you're ready, we'll get started and see if we can't get testimony out of the way, and we'll move on. Good afternoon, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe each of you have in front of you a summary of my comments in slide form. I understand the request for brevity today, so I'll move this through this rather quickly and only be guided by your questions should you have any in certain areas. So we've been before the House and the Senate on numerous occasions and provided testimony, and basically I'm here today to reiterate and say that we stand by our previous testimony in terms of the overall tax credit rate. We believe that 20% tax rate with a 20% credit is in the best, still in the best interest of Alaska, as provide additional balance between investment and tax credits. So we'll just move down. I know you've had discussion on a lot of these. The cook inlet provision, we acknowledge, is added to the Senate bill, and we certainly support that and believe that is appropriate. We appreciate the work that was done and that our message was heard that the cook inlet is in its very different stage of life than is the North Slope, and that this allowance of the 5% credit will indeed extend the life of the cook inlet assets and encourage additional investment that we feel is so vital to the state's key economic area, both in the terms of oil production and also through the 7.5% provide additional incentives for gas exploration and development.
For the record, Representative Moses has joined us.
Gotcha.
In terms of the standard deduction, there are two proposals out now. We could support either the 12 million credit or the 5,000 barrel a day. If I had to vote, though, I would clearly vote for the $12 million credit. I believe it makes the most sense. It's the most simplistic approach. And being we're being taxed in dollars, it seems relatively straightforward that our credit would also be applied back in dollars rather than in barrels. Transition capital. The version coming over from the Senate has the, basically, you have to earn your transition capital all over again by investing. We accept the premise, although we'd certainly prefer the original bill where you would just allow that transitional credit based on your previous investments and the previous decisions you've made here and the expectations you had when you made those investments that you would be under a certain tax regime. We can accept, though, that you have to earn those all over again by spending capital in the future. We would urge, though, that the time frame be extended a bit, perhaps to 10 years. I think this could be in the best interest of the state because what we really want us to do is spend money smartly and not quickly. And by doing two for one, you're kind of forcing us to spend it quickly if we want to get that credit. And I think good, smart investment is in everybody's interest. So please consider extending that out.
You're not saying, though, John, that you would spend money foolishly.
Certainly not. Okay. Not intentionally, Mr. Chairman. On the effective date, I got to apologize here. I'd like to call that April 1 a typo, but actually somehow my brain misfired when I typed this up. I intended to say July 1, if you could make that correction. It's earliest.
You've been getting the same kind of pressure we have.
Is the earliest reasonable date to begin this. I think we will be highly challenged to be effective. The regulations won't, I'm sure, be written by July 1. I think there's a good case could be made that this date should actually be pushed back later in the year until we actually understand the regulations under which we'll be taxed. But July 1, given the grace period that's in place, you know, at least it's conceivable that we would have a shot at it. So I would recommend that change. The next bullet I have is under Challenge Doyle in deference to House Bill 498, I believe, which is in circulation. Even in our original proposal, we had recommended that there be an additional credit for viscous oil development. Challenged oil broadens the definition of that a bit. And the reason here being that there's a large, large resource there available to the state to be developed. And although there's concerns that these credits add additional risk to the state in terms of how big a percentage of the pie is being basically subsidized by the state, I think there's another risk out there, and that's that this oil just stays in the ground forever or for much longer than it needs to. And I think an additional incentive here on that could get it moving. If you look over to the east, to Alberta, you can see they had challenged oil called the heavy oil sands. They've given some very favorable treatment on that, and they've got an economic boom on their hands trying to get that asset developed.
John, would you say that this is an issue that would be warranted or would need to be taken care of at this time versus in its own separate piece of legislation? Or, you know, if it was your choice to see, would you rather see it in this PPT bill, or would you rather see it in its own piece of legislation?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a strong preference. It seems there would be some simplicity just to rolling it into this bill and having credits established for certain things at this point in time. Okay. An abandonment expense that is addressed in the Senate bill, basically saying that the relative percentage of the oil produced from assets once this bill is in effect can be applied to the abandonment expense when it's time to abandon the fields. And although I personally might like to see a little different definition, I think that one certainly has a sense of fairness to it. We invested under a certain tax regime under which we were entirely responsible for abandonment. Now it's changing, and the state is choosing to become more in the oil business with us. In return for that, you're getting a higher tax rate. So it only seems fair that when it comes time to clean up, that you're still in business with us and allowing us to deduct that percent of the abandonment that's associated with the oil that was produced under the PPT tax regime. Gas storage costs. I hate to admit, but that's a new item. I haven't talked about it before. It's getting a little late in the game maybe to bring something new to the table, but it's one of these areas that I think could lead to future disagreements if it's not explicitly addressed now. Gas storage is a very valuable service, especially in the Cook Inlet area where it helps meet the winter peaks to provide home heating and electrical generation. It is not explicitly covered in the bill, so I fear that when we get down the road with regulations, it'll be a point of dispute in the future. The alternative to putting in gas storage is to drill many, many more wells at great cost that will only be produced for a few days during the year. So those type of costs would be covered under the PPT because it would be drilling wells, et cetera. But gas storage, as I said now, I cannot see that it's specifically included or excluded, so my preference would be listed as an included expense and therefore remove the ambiguity going forward.
Representative Kelly.
Just on that issue, John, usually pump storage like that, at least in a hydro or electrical application, the product brings a higher price at retail. I guess I just have to think that that is a new item, and that that could have a little different twist than the average market price gas. Maybe since that increases the profit, I'll have to think about that. Anything that will help that understanding of why that's the same thing as the regular gas.
Through the chair, Kelly, in the Cook Inlet, where gas is priced on long-term contracts, there is no differentiation for gas coming out of storage versus gas that's just produced out of the wells in terms of price. The way I think of it is gas storage is one of the things we have to do to get our gas ready for market, which includes meeting those winter peaks. So it's kind of like a processing or a treatment charge in a way. It's what's required to get the gas ready to meet the market. And certainly the new utility contracts that reflect Henry Hub prices certainly have a component of an average price throughout the year, which includes delivering that winter peak. So there's that component there that it's part of meeting the obligation. But on the other hand, it's the most capital efficient an effective way to meet that obligation, as opposed to other things would be higher cost.
Mr. Chairman, so you don't have a two-part pricing mechanism for
through the chair, Representative Kelly, there is a provision in the NSTAR contract that calls for an additional $1 MCF, what is called peaking. But that is only in effect if another producer fails to meet their obligations, and we have to cover for them, basically. So there's no separate, like this year, our price for gas selling to NSTAR is $6.19. Whether it's July or whether it's January, it doesn't matter. Same price.
Okay, carry to the extreme. That can be LNG tanks on site. Covers, I mean, we can carry it far enough downstream. It's storage. I'll have to think about that. I'm not necessarily against it. It just seems to add a new, little bit of a new wrinkle that I'd like to know a little more about. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Joe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last item I'd like to talk about is progressivity. This is something I feel pretty strongly about and how it should be handled. First, I'd like to state we don't support progressivity in any form, but I understand there's been a lot of discussion, and the policy call has been made to include progressivity, and with the realization that will be a disincentive ultimately for long-term investment. So if we're going to have progressivity, I'd like to recommend we make it as logical and sensible and workable as possible. So over on the next page, I have my understanding, the reason that the state wants progressivity is to get a fair share when there is a price run-up that's accompanied by large profits. So in other words, if there were an event that would take prices from today's levels to $100 or something because of a disruption, and our cost did not increase but the profits increased proportional to the price of oil, then that would be a windfall, and that would be the desire is to get a higher percentage of that. But we're thinking about a tax here that's nominally going to be in place for 20 or 30 years. And my understanding is not the desire of the state that if oil prices go up, as they certainly will over that long period of time, we know costs will go up also over that long period of time. So how profitability plays out is yet to be seen, and it's certainly not directly proportional to oil price. So this is not intended to be a creeping tax increase based on inflation. So problems with progressivity as currently proposed, and I acknowledge that the Senate made significant progress on a couple issues. If you're going to base it on gross, they've moved to an ANS price, which is a better marker certainly than WTI, and to the wellhead, which allows for transportation deductions. But they have not solved the basic problem that we are indexing a net tax to a gross number based on your gross revenues. A number like $50 may seem reasonable today as a trigger price to define excess profits, But I certainly can't say 20 or 30 years out that it's still a reasonable price to define excess profits. And I would note that under the, also under the current Senate bill, if I've done my math correctly, that at $250 an MCF, the tax is 100%. And in fact, there's nothing to stop it from going over 100% if you went above that. And $250 may seem like an outrageous price, and it is today, but who can say in 20 years that that's an outrageous price? So I think we need to be very careful and circumspect when we peg our taxes to one number that is not tied at all directly to profitability.
So, John, would by that statement, I don't want to put you on the spot, would you, are you in favor or against a long-term PPT oil contract?
Mr. Chairman, all of a sudden I feel like I'm right on the spot. I think that the reason we're talking about a 20 or 30 year contract probably has nothing to do with my company right now, so maybe I'll just defer on that response if you don't mind.
Thanks, Joe. Representative Kelly.
Just while you're sneaking up on John, maybe we'll sneak up a little further. Where do you want that to lay over and go flat? I mean, you're talking about 50%. You're worried about it going to infinity minus, and I understand that, but where do you want it to flop over sideways?
I'm going to get to that.
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, I've got a specific proposal here in a page or two. So I think I made the point that I'm concerned about pegging it just to price and that the high cost, we know costs will go up and will increase over time. On the next slide, slide number four, I guess it's numbered, is why we should be concerned about costs. And this is something that was just published this past week by Cambridge Energy Research Associates, CERA, which is certainly one of the leading energy consulting companies in the world. And I'm actually quite surprised they haven't been brought into this process in a consulting role at this point in time. And they put out a report called Rising Capital Costs Bear Down on E&P Profitability. And if you'll bear with me, I think I'll just read this so that anyone who may be listening can actually hear these quotes. And the first quote is, higher oil and gas prices have encouraged a wave of new investments for discovery and developing resources. However, the soaring costs of exploration and production programs and the volatility of energy prices have left many producers uneasy about future profit margins. The second quote, E&P capital costs are accelerating and have increased approximately 42% from 2000 to 2005, compared with 15% rise in the consumer price index. And finally, increasing costs and energy price volatility are having an impact on investments. Oil and gas prospects or projects that were profitable at $22 per barrel in 2002 now require $35 per barrel to achieve the same or similar returns. So that should be pretty sobering to anyone, especially the state of Alaska, who's now thinking about getting in the oil business in a more direct way and taking the risk, the cost risk, right along with the producers. I've stated before that the people in this room who've been brought in this room to testify yesterday and today are the producers, but they're not the only, that's not the oil industry in Alaska in its entirety. We also have service companies, drilling companies, engineering firms, everyone out there, and they see the profits that are coming in through high oil prices, and just like the state is now saying, we want our fair share, all those companies are saying they want their fair share too, and inevitably costs are going to track up with oil prices. So, and this is why I'm concerned that when we peg the index just to the WTI without looking at the net effect, we're getting in a place where we're going to have a tax increase even though profitability is not increasing. Over on slide number five, so here's a proposal for progressivity based on net profits. And I think this is relatively simple and elegant solution. in that every company is already, every month, they're going to be paying their taxes on this net tax. So we'll be calculating it each month, and we'll certainly know what our production is for each month. So we can simply divide the net profits into the barrels of oil equivalent and come up with the net profits per BOE. And we should set the trigger based on that net profits per BOE. And what I would suggest and have suggested in the past that be set at $50 per barrel of net profits, and that it increase at 1% for each $5 increase in profits. Now, in the original Senate CS, I believe they adopted this methodology. They chose to tweak with the numbers a little bit, which is not a big surprise. They had suggested $45 per BOE as the target, and actually the 1% per $5 was adjusted to 1% for $10. So they basically lowered the starting price but flattened the incline rate. And certainly that's kind of a policy call, but I think the basic methodology needs to be considered very carefully. So this would give a minimum rate, assuming we're at 2020, of 20% tax. The minimum rate would correspond to whatever the final adopted PPT tax is. And I would also propose a cap at 30% tax. There's a lot of, I think, good reasons why you need to carefully consider a cap. First, when we go back to the $50, as I proposed, $50 kickoff price, I think, to be fair and balanced, that really should be in real terms, because we'll certainly have inflation, and $50 of profit in the future is not the same as $50 of profit today. But I realize you're going down a slippery slope there in terms of rationalizing how that's appropriate when I'm saying further down below that this takes inflation into account. By putting a cap on it, I think we give the producers some comfort that it's not going to go away. Your profits are not going to get eaten away by inflation to very small numbers. Also, a 30% cap is certainly, I think, very reasonable given that this is just one of the components of income that the state will get off of production, and is not too far away from the, you know, Governor Hammond, who I didn't have the pleasure to know or to meet, but many of you did, and I've heard often quoted his idea of a third to the state, a third to the federal government, and a third to the companies. And well, here we'd be almost at a third just through this PPP tax directly to the companies. So it would also help, I think, get by the general idea of progressivity all. And if you recall back, there's been a lot of testimony on probability distributions and how companies count on that upside case when they make their investments. So by putting a cap on this, you would still preserve some of that upside case and would mitigate the problems that companies have with the progressivity in general. So I think the advantages of this concept, that it's self-correcting for inflation in terms of oil field costs. If costs goes up, then your profitability will obviously be affected by that. We won't have to worry about pegging it to ANS or WTI or anything else. We won't have to worry about what the appropriate inflation factor is. You're also taking into account different types of production. If you're in a heavy oil program that is just a higher cost type of business than a light oil business, that would also be taken into account. But it will effectively capture any windfall taxes. If prices go up dramatically without an increase in cost, then your taxes will go up proportionally. So in my view, this system is fair to everybody. Since the taxes and progressivity will only be tied to actual company profits and not inferred just from the gross receipts. On the next page, I have a couple examples of how this might work. Case number one, I call the windfall case. And this is a case the state is trying to cover and make sure that their interests are protected. You see there's two columns there. First line says average revenue per BOE. And I said, let's assume we're at $60 in case one, and then in case two it goes up to $110. At that same time, our expense per BOE was at 7 and stayed at 7. Our capital was at 3. So you see the net profit in this case went from $50 to $100. And under my proposal, the tax rate would go from 20% to 30%. So the state would get instead of $10 per barrel, we get $30 per barrel. The second case shows where costs, where prices go up, but costs go up not as fast, but they go up significantly. So the costs went from $7 to $37. But because of the higher price, your profit went from $50 to $70. So in this case, you would still see a tax increase, but it would recognize the increased cost as well. So you would go from 20% to 24%, and your taxes would go from $10 to $16.80 per barrel.
And then the final case, and this is the one I think that is an extreme endpoint, but just to illustrate the point, where you still go from $60 to $110, so your expense per barrel goes from $7 to $57. In other words, all the increase in price is eaten up by your increase in costs, so your profit stays at $50 a barrel, the taxes stay at the same rate, and your and the tax you pay would still stay at $10 a barrel. So those are a couple examples. Interestingly enough, under this proposal, if producers were able to actually come up with a way to cut costs, the state would actually see an increase in revenue without an increase in oil price. So it would work both ways. So my final summary comments that I'd like to leave you with is we believe the net profits is a fair and logical method to implement progressivity as opposed to basing it on the gross receipts. We believe the Cook Inlet 5% tax is in the best interest of the state and urge you to retain that provision or similar provision. In general, I'd urge a cautious approach to increasing taxes. There's a lot of discussion about growing the pie, and we think we all agree that growing the pie is the best answer. There's differences on how to do that, obviously, and what the effects of different things would be, but if we were to err on the side of taxing at too low a rate, then we, you know, could have the problem of too much economic growth, too much drilling, et cetera. So I know there's a delicate balance there, but if I were voting, I would certainly consider the ramifications of being too high or too low, since, you know, in all likelihood, looking back in 20 years, we won't say we've gotten it perfect. Also, certainly want to acknowledge the hard work and dedication of all the legislators I've met with and talked with over the past month or two. I know it's a very challenging task, and the historic nature of this bill is certainly front and center in everyone's mind. And then finally, I'd like to spend, as I have every one of my discussions, that Chevron has been in Alaska for many years, and we intend to be here for many more years, assuming that we can find a regime that works for everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Fatula.
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Zager. I'm trying to understand, you know, what would jump your costs up from $7 to $57? And I just am wondering, is there a way that we can measure backwards? Like, what have your costs risen in this time frame with the price rise? I mean, how long does it take to get that to go to $57?
Through the chair, Representative, this was intended to be an illustrative example. But I think if you're thinking out in terms of decades, it's hard to predict exactly what will happen. You can see from the one reference I provided from Sarah, Cambridge Energy Research Associates, the costs have gone up, I think it was 40% in approximately 5 years. So if you want to extrapolate out, even at a modest inflation factor from that for 20 years, I think you can see how you could easily get up in the area where your costs are five or more times what they are today. So there's a lot of inflationary factors. Like I said, when drilling rigs become short, like they are today, the drilling companies, you know, they raise their prices. And we've been told by some companies that they're going to keep raising them until they have rigs stacked, because then they know they hit the price where people won't pay it anymore. But, you know, so their service companies, and they're out to make profit just like everyone else, are doing their best to carve as much of the profit out of the energy business as they can. It's just inevitable.
Representative Curtula?
Do you see a difference between the large producers and the smaller companies in this regard? I think it's more difficult for you guys to be able to, you know, that your costs are going to naturally rise faster, maybe? I mean, that may be something that really is a concern. I haven't thought about it before, but...
I think it would be hard to generalize too much in that respect. Certainly, big companies have an advantage in terms of scale and contracting over little companies. They can, because they're offering, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of business a year, can certainly negotiate better prices than smaller companies. And to some degree, it matters your worldwide scale on negotiating these contracts. In some cases, it doesn't matter too much if you're, for instance, in the Cook Inlet, there's really only a couple of rigs that are there. And, you know, if there comes a period of time when they're staffed, they will either leave the state because they've got business somewhere else, or if you're competing, the prices will just go up. So your worldwide scale doesn't matter too much when you're down to looking at, for instance, one rig in the Cook Inlet. Well, but conversely, if you want to begin a new program on the North Slope, you're going to have to bid for a rig probably out of Canada, where they've got more work they can do. You may be forced to build a new rig if you really want it. And then you're paying high prices and waiting, you know, 12, 18, 24 months for your rig. So those are examples of, yeah, cost inflation will be serious if oil stays up. It's already come up dramatically. And the trend is, right now, it's not abating at this point in time.
Have you seen your own costs going up in this last period with the price? I mean, the last year, have you seen your costs going up?
Through the chair, Representative Tula, certainly. I don't have numbers with me today, but I think the numbers that were presented there in that quote would not. They're representative of the energy industry as a whole. I think Alaska's probably no exception to those type of numbers. I can't give you specifics on day rates for rigs or costs for specific services, but it's inevitable that costs will go up with the profitability of the producers.
Okay. Thank you.
John, on that number five there, so you prefer the net. If you don't like progressivity, I understand that, but you prefer the net over the gross. And this is on the profit portion. So would we assume that your example here uses a WTI of roughly on the oil of roughly $60 before the progressive hits? Is that ballpark? And then it lays over at what, $110? That'd be in the West Texas. I was trying to get convert that from profit to what did the oil price do in your example.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Kelly, I think you've looked at it correctly. In my examples here, what I'm saying is the $60, it's just an oil price. It could be WTI, it could be ANS in this example. And I'm trying to effectively illustrate that costs, your oil price certainly can go up, and profitability is not a one-to-one relationship between oil price and what you get at the end of the day, because you have all these other factors involved.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Joe, thanks for coming. Mr. Chairman. I may have some other questions for you later, but I'll contact you. Next, we will move on to Pioneer, President Ken Sheffield. Good afternoon, Jim.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ken Sheffield. I'm the president of Pioneer Natural Resources Alaska. Appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today, and I also want to express my appreciation for all your hard work during the PPT legislation. I've seen the dedication from all of you over the last couple of months. I believe Pioneer is a good example of the type of investor that the state is trying to attract. In a little over 3 years, we have become a major investor on the North Slope. And we are also looking at a major project in the Cook Inlet. We've been an aggressive explorer over the last several years. We've participated in wells in NPRA. This past winter, we moved a new rig up to the North Slope and drilled three exploration wells. Earlier in the first quarter of this year, we sanctioned a major development project up on the North Slope, our GRUIT project. It's about half a billion dollar project, and development activities are underway as we speak. When we look at our portfolio through the governor's bill, what we see is a modest incentive for Pioneer to invest more aggressively. We believe that the governor's bill struck a delicate balance between incentives and taxes. When we view the House and Senate bills, we believe that with some adjustments, they can be modified to be a modest incentive for investment as well. And I'll go through several bullet points here. With respect to tax rate, for oil, we would recommend a 20% rate. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about that, and I won't belabor that issue. We do think that 20% is a balanced tax rate and would maximize investment in the state. With respect to gas, we support the proposal in Senate Bill 305 for the 7.5% rate. Obviously, gas, the lack of infrastructure in the state, gas is more challenged than oil. We also support the Cook Inlet provision in Senate Bill 305 for the 5% rate. I think it's pretty obvious to everyone that Cook Inlet is quite a mature basin and the opportunities are not as robust. And considering our position in the Cook Inlet, we are facing a major decision on our Cosmopolitan opportunity, and the outcome of this bill could affect our decision whether to move forward with that project or not. With respect to the base allowance, Senate Bill 305 includes a 5,000 barrel per day equivalent credit capped at $14 million. When we look at the calculation methodology that's in Senate Bill 305, under certain cases, the more we invest actually yields a lower tax credit. So, and it's partly due to the fact that you multiply the 22.5% by 5,000 barrels a day divided by your production in barrels per day, then by the net income instead of the gross income. So it's sort of a disincentive to spend more money in that regard. It also contains
Could you go over that again, just a little slower, so that I could catch why it's how that works?
Yes, and it's been a little difficult for us to understand as well. But essentially, the way the formula works, you multiply the 22.5% by 5,000 barrels per day, divided by whatever you're producing, and if you have a number larger than that, obviously that factor is smaller than one. And then that's multiplied by the net income. And it can actually result in a tax credit much smaller than the cap. Anyway, I'd be happy to, offline.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd like to run through it with the numbers to understand it.
It's an easy thing to see if you put the numbers down. It's a hard thing
right.
to explain in words.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure they put up 9 or 10 graphs on that. We could use some more graphs.
We could have more made if you so desire.
No, I'm okay.
Okay.
I was being facetious, Mr. Sheffield, because I know the information you'll provide will be satisfactory.
With respect to the 10-year sunset provision, it is somewhat problematic for explorers due to the long cycle time of exploration. You know, by the time you acquire leases, shoot seismic, drill a number of exploration wells, and if you're lucky enough to have a discovery and then put the project together and put it online, by the time that has elapsed, the sunset provision is just a couple of years away. The time frame is just too short for those who are conducting exploration. So what we recommend is the House Resources Committee substitute methodology. It's much simpler. You have a flat tax credit currently at $12 million. We have a few requested changes we would like to see. The $12 million increase to $14 million. We'd like to see the elimination of the annual investment requirement. It's not a problem. If you look at Pioneer's portfolio, we think we'll have plenty of investment. But what I'm concerned about is for the state of Alaska is actually the investors that might be smaller than Pioneer and don't have that regular investment every year. They may have a big investment in 1 year, but in subsequent years, they may not have those investments and wouldn't be able to utilize the base allowance.
Would you propose a trigger?
Mr. Chairman, a trigger.
On like data production?
Yes, sir. What we would propose is if the sunset provision is required, that in lieu of that, we would look at like a 10-year window upon first utilization of the credits. So each party would be able to elect when they would start to utilize those credits. Thank you. Another issue that's important to Pioneer and other independents is, are we fundable credits? The House Resources CS contains $10 million of credits annually. It's a significant incentive to explorers who have no current production. There's a thin market for the credits due to the small number of buyers. This will allow explorers to receive full value for at least some of our credits at no extra cost to the state of Alaska. And we are requesting that you consider an increase in that to $30 million annually. And we would also like to request that the credits potentially apply to lease bonuses and rentals. My next item is transition capital, and specifically the sunset provision. Pioneer has invested over $100 million in the state, and we, based on our forecast, we will easily spend the 2-for-1 going forward to earn back those credits. But with the current sunset provision, we wouldn't be able to capture a reasonable amount of those credits that we had already earned back. So we would like to request that the sunset provision be eliminated. But if a sunset provision is required, we would request that it be 7 years following first utilization of the credits. With respect to progressivity, certainly, we don't support the concept unless it was offset by some lower rates at lower prices. However, I think it is something that that seems to be a reality. And if it's required, we certainly support the work that Chevron has done and think that it should be based upon the net profit calculations that are already a part of the PPT methodology. And we support the profit trigger that existed in the Senate Bill 305 draft. And my last item is point of production for gas. we're concerned that gas treatment facilities should qualify for the tax credits just like they do for oil. And it's just a simple reason. It's a fairness issue because the facilities are required to make the gas marketable for sale. And with that, I'll answer any of your questions.
Any questions? Thank you for your testimony. Next, we will move on to John Barnes, production manager for Marathon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ken. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Barnes with Marathon Oil Company. I thank you for this opportunity, again, to testify regarding PGT. As you know, Marathon's activities are focused on the Cook Inlet natural gas business, which provides heating, natural gas, electricity, and contributes to employment for 70% of the population of the state of Alaska. Additionally, Cook Inlet oil, as well as gas, has value in that it's an important feedstock to local refining. I think you've heard a consistent message being developed from industry, which makes my job very easy, actually. I only need to point out one or two critical factors. The industry is coming together on several important points as the state begins to consider this production tax. Before I talk to the specifics, though, I would like to ask you to turn to the second page of my exhibits. I wanted to take a look at where Alaska stacked up over the last 13 years competitively against the North American oil and gas business. On this plot, you'll see three series of data. The first are the little blue diamonds. Could be circles. My eyes aren't what they used to be, but that represents West Texas oil price, and it was flat at about 20 for a number of years, and we're all aware of the recent run-up in price, which has led to issues regarding profits for companies and probably has contributed to this PPT discussion. The green diamonds represent North American rig count, which is data that I got from the Baker Hughes rig count website. I averaged it for the last 13 years. It's an excellent measure of inlet of activity for our industry. And what you'll see is a very strong correlation in activity to product price, which should be no surprise. Just by reference, over the last run-up, which has begun about April of 01, lasted 4 or 5 years now, while oil prices have gone from $20 to $60 a barrel, the rig count in North America has gone from about 700 to over 2,000 drilling rigs working. Alternatively, if you look at the brown dots, which go to the axis on the left, unfortunately, rig rate in Alaska has not been similarly driven by product price. It's stayed flat at about 10, plus or minus 2 or 3 over the last decade plus. A lot of factors contribute to that. It's an overall state of Alaska picture. I think it's frankly sobering in my mind as to the activity level that we're really not seeing here. That same message is what I've talked about in previous testimony regarding the Cook Inlet. The Cook Inlet's a subset of this, and I echo much of the testimony from John Zager regarding operating costs and other factors that make it difficult to operate in Alaska. I'll turn my discussion now specifically to PPT, the third slide. PPT has been described as a world-class or a world-equivalent tax structure. And I think we're all aware that there's one project that's really driving this, and that's the North Slope gas line linked to other investment on the North Slope. I won't run through all the details. Marathon was not part of that discussion, not part of that negotiation. But the bottom bullet there, where I mentioned that a strong North Slope industry benefits the state of Alaska, as well as the Cook Inlet industry is important The Cook Inlet is a very small industry. It depends on state infrastructure that you see through strong contractors, available equipment, etc. So we are tied indirectly to the success of the North Slope. But the Cook Inlet is not the North Slope. We've had previous testimony. I've described the issues that are going on in the inlet, as well as the discussions regarding the need for incentivization. For these reasons, the Cook Inlet needs to be recognized as different, and it needs to be addressed differently. And we're seeing that happen in CS 305 from the Senate side. But there are some issues that Marathon would suggest requests that we continue to look at. And that's my fourth slide. The first point, there's a differentiation between Cook Inlet oil and Cook Inlet gas. They're each has its pros and cons. The oil, which we don't produce much of, has a very high operating cost environment, but at least it enjoys, to some degree, market prices. The Cook Inlet gas historically has sold at a discount. There are strong drivers in the state of Alaska to keep Cook Inlet gas prices low. So there's a bit of a disagreement there between taxing you as though you receive world prices, but preventing you from receiving that same price. That leads to my second point. Cook Inlet investments compete with North American gas. I've talked about that in previous testimony as well. I've described the differences in economics and why capital isn't being strongly drawn into the Cook Inlet. The remedy for that is incentivization, 7.5%, clearly better than 20%. Marathon previously testified that 5% made sense. That's not there in the Senate bill. We would like to suggest that it be considered. Finally, as to the issue of progressivity, there's been a lot of discussion about the complexities of it, whether it should be there or not, the purpose of it. Long and short of it is, we don't really support progressivity on the gas side. It's not explicitly in the Senate bill, CS, right now. We believe that it places volatility and risk on Alaska consumers, testified about that. But if progressivity is deemed for policy reasons to be used, that needs to be based on the net, not the gross. I can echo Mr. Zager's concerns about costs. They are going up. If anybody has tried to build anything lately with plywood, with steel, I think you understand what's gone on in the construction industry, the housing industry. The same factors, plus some, are affecting the oil and gas industry. Finally, it ought to be based on actual transaction value. It should not be based on any type of an outside market price. It's not appropriate to tax an industry based on things that are going on elsewhere. You ought to tax it on the actual results. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. And again, I'll echo previous comments. We thank you for the work you've done. We understand it's a very difficult issue to work through. And not many of us are like Solomon. We can't solve everything. So you guys have to do your best. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Sean, I have one. Representative Petula, go ahead.
Well, I'm really interested in this graph that you've got that shows that the Alaska rig count is going along. And to me, that just shows that, you know, even when we had hardly any tax under the ELF, we weren't seeing the kind of investment that we need. So, you know, it says to me also that even if we reduce taxes, I'm just not so sure that the industry responds. I mean, that graph sort of shows the picture of what we've been going through. So that really concerns me.
Through the chair, Representative Kurtula, many, many factors obviously apply here. Some fields pay taxes, a severance tax, some don't under ELF. Companies were able to factor those tax structures into investment decisions. I previously have commented about permitting and other issues, but I am very much in line with your view that there's a message there, and I believe it's a very tough nut to crack.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for bringing the graph in. That just sort of lays it right out. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tudor. Representative Jewell, do you have a question? John, I was looking at the graph also, and I probably would come at it from a different point of view, maybe. I don't know who put the rig count together, but would you say that there's considerable difference between the cost of a rig that we use in the Cook Inlet or on the North Slope than what there is in West Texas?
Representative Schnall, you're correct. There's the data. I went to the Baker Hughes account site. They have monthly counts. Offshore, onshore, North America, Canada, and I chose to try to simplify it. So what you have is an annual average there, which takes flattens out some of the noise, but there are considerable differences, and our costs are much, much higher than lower 48 rig rates, and it's consistent with the message that we are a high-cost environment, and you have to have good, strong projects. It really goes to the comments that the industry has stated for a number of years about cost environment, permitting, lead time, and other issues that make this a very difficult industry in Alaska, frankly.
Do they consider coiled tubing units rigs?
Representative Chenault, I don't believe so.
I guess that, you know, scratches the bump of the major philosophic issue that I keep struggling with, and that is we're assuming by giving you the tax rate on a very certain basis for a long term, and we're giving you this tax credit that you don't have now, that you're going to invest in Alaska and fill the pipeline with oil and fill our coffers with money, yet we have to take it on faith that you're going to do all these things, because if it gets dumped into a longer-term contract with no ability to change it, then we're harming ourselves, and we're taking it on your, and I'm using you as a symbol, on your word, that all this is going to happen in the future. So,
Representative Wyrock, through the chair, I represent Marathon Oil, the gas company in the Cook Inlet, and I understand the significant policy issues that are there.
You have a question?
Again, Mr. Chairman, yeah. That wasn't directed, that was directed at you, you understand. I'm just articulating that. It's a big hump.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? Thank you, John.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Hanley. Darko Petroleum, Alaska Public Affairs Manager, Mr. Mark Hanley. Good afternoon, Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify. My name is Mark Hanley. I'm the Public Affairs Manager for Anadarko in Alaska. And as I go through, I think I'll address our view, too, of some of that last discussion, but I'll touch on it when we get to the tax escalator. I understand you want a fairly brief overview, try and touch on some key points. I won't go through everything in the bill. If people have questions, obviously I'm more than happy to answer them about this or anything else that I haven't touched on. I would just say, rather than repeat my testimony, I think our goal is somewhat similar to yours, is to have a fair tax system that encourages more exploration and development, that gets more oil in the pipeline to stem that declining production, because I do agree that the declining production, while masked right now by the higher prices, is really a significant concern. And it's a concern for companies like ours, not just because of the oil production, but you know, the costs go up on that transportation system as well. So, again, our initial reaction to the governor's bill was, look, this is a tax increase on existing production. That's what this is. The money that you're getting is on existing production. We have some of that. We aren't able to use the credits for that existing production, a little bit on transition. So this is a big tax increase on existing production. For our company, the reason we could come out and support it was because the credits and deductions and the way it was structured did provide additional incentive for us to go out and explore. We see ourselves as an exploration company. So that balanced off. That increase in taxes was our exploration economics improved. We think it'll mean we can drill some more wells. We can't guarantee you that we're going to find more, but of course we wouldn't be drilling if we didn't think we could find some oil. But that's our goal. So we have always measured this, all the changes against kind of how does that compare to even the existing system. And maybe I will just touch on that a little bit at this point. Part of the reason, at least our view, is the reason you didn't see those rigs counts go up and it was fairly stable is you could look, most of the time the price was at $20 a barrel. And I've testified before that I got to tell you, if the price was at $20 a barrel, we wouldn't be drilling or we wouldn't be looking at many of these prospects. Part of the reason we are is the price is getting up into that range. And I think I showed a chart before from Econ 1, but it was really a USGS chart about the number of additional economically recoverable barrels of oil as that price went up between 40, 50, and 60. And it was a pretty steep slope. And I would say we're getting into that range now where people, we have higher prices, people have moved their forecasts up, and we're starting to see the ability to drill. So I would say, and that's one of my arguments about if you're going to do progressivity, I'm jumping a little bit ahead in my testimony, but I pitched this before. If you're going to do progressivity, start it higher. Leave us in that range where we're just starting to get these projects economic, and you can capture the upside. Don't get me wrong, but start it higher than what we've seen. We were arguing for a $60 or higher equivalent price. We would argue for the net as well, going to the net. But let me just go through briefly a couple of key points. The tax rate, of course, you've heard from everybody. We support the 20% tax rate. We think the lower the tax, the higher the investment on oil. We have testified that we think gas is less economic than oil, and so we support the approach that the Senate has taken on a lower tax rate for gas. And to the extent that I would say a 2020 is where we would support, but to the extent you want to raise the tax rate, we do think you ought to consider the increasing the credits to offset that.
Representative Petrillo.
Thank you. Let me ask a question, though. If we reduce the tax rate on the gas to the 7.5%, why should we give 100% of the credits still? And I hear what you're saying. If you raise the tax, raise the credits, I can understand that. But why would you reduce the tax and then leave the credits the same? That doesn't balance out to me.
Sure. Well, through the chair, Representative Kapula, I think gas, you know, it's a balancing. It's where you balance that act out. But I would say that the incentives and the credits are what help your economics. So it's just a matter of, As we show the charts from Dr. Van Uers and we did our charts before, you're going to see how that improves your economics or doesn't improve those economics. So it's a balancing act out there. If you take the credits all the way down and the tax all the way down, then you may not have improved your economics. So,
which would balance better for you, leaving the tax up but keeping the credits up or taking them down?
Generally speaking, the tax rate, you know, as we've described before, there's a 4 or 5 to 1 kind of ratio on that. So having a lower tax rate, everything else being equal, is important. That's what drives things. But again, it depends on what your desire is. Because if all you do is just increase the tax rate from under the current system, but don't provide credits as well, part of the problem you're going to have is the economics have decreased. You can't just increase your taxes and not provide anything else without some incentive. Then you'll decrease the expiration economics as well. So it is a balancing act out there. And where you choose that, of course, that's the policy call that you guys get to make.
Seems to me that the balance is a little out of whack in the Senate version right at the second, but I understand what you're saying. Thank you.
Sure. On the what we call the tax escalator, I think we would agree with the comments from before, which is we think it ought to be applied to the net income. That accounts for the cost issues that are out there. We think the trigger point ought to be higher on an equivalent basis than it is at $50 a barrel. And so we would support generally the comments that you've heard before. And again, back to my original point, we're just starting to get a range where people are making some of these fields or prospects are becoming economic, and we would ask that you start that progressivity up at a point where you don't start slicing that off before you even have a chance to make some of these things economic. The effective date, actually, to be fair, we would argue that July 1st, starting a tax bill after
being effective after it passes, we would suggest that's a fair way to do taxes. The $73 million allowance, which has taken all kinds of versions here, I would agree with some of the comments earlier. I think, generally speaking, the House approach with a $12 million credit, or obviously we'd prefer a $14 million credit. I think the sunset, as has been described, creates problems for players that don't have existing production. If you put a sunset on a production incentive for somebody that has no production, new players won't have the ability to take it. So either eliminate the sunset or let people take it. You know, the 10 years would start from the time when the application for the first credit begins. So then each company would be able to get the 10 years. So you still allow that for companies that don't have production existing today. So I think that's a fair approach. The transition allowance, we generally support the approach that has come over in the Senate bill, what's referred to as the two-for-one. I would just point out, while I don't particularly have a problem, I mean, there's also a sunset on that. It's a seven-year sunset. Obviously, we'd like that extended slightly, but there are two things going on here. One is the amount of time when you can earn that credit, and there's another when you can actually use the credit. And again, you get with people that don't have production. So here's somebody that spent, some money previously. They go do the two-for-one. You're trying to get that extra spending out there, but they don't have production to use it against, so they run out of time to even use it. So I think there's a problem there. And I've heard suggestions, I would not encourage this, but that the $40 price limit that was in the governor's original bill may be considered to come back. In other words, you cannot take these credits when the price of oil is under $40 a barrel. Particularly if you do that, you should not have a sunset on these. In other words, we can't control the price, and the governor's original bill did not. In other words, you have a certain amount of time to earn the credits. Once you earn them, you can take them on a certain schedule, and if for some reason the $40 is off, you can't take them, you roll those forward. And I would encourage that approach as well. So the sunset is a concern for a number of reasons in this particular division.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. It makes some sense to me what you're saying about the 10 years starting when in that sunset, but not to have any sunset puts us in a real precarious position, and I know you know this probably better than I do, having sat in the chairman's seat, about how you get all those credits out there at some point. You really have a budget that's going up and down. You have any thoughts on how to deal with that?
Chair Representative Petula, and there's two different sunsets. I just went through the
right. You went through the first one and then the second.
The $73 million, and that's a 10-year.
Right.
And like
that
I said,
makes sense.
Okay,
yeah.
So. On the transition allowance, what happens is it's actually 7 years, I believe, in the bill. And again, the goal is to recover. I'll give you the example for Anadarko. We're probably the ones that got caught right in the middle of this thing, right, where we timed our investments just wrong. We have a $500 million gross expenditures on two satellites that happened in the last year and a half. So what's going to happen is, we won't get any credits for those. We're going to get a higher tax rate. But if we would have held off just a year and a half, we'd have got all these credits and taxes. So that transition allowance that lets us go back and capture some of that, if we spend twice as much money in the future, allows us potentially to capture some of that. Let's say we go spend twice as much money. We only have 7 years to do that, to earn back from the 5 years. But there's a problem of when can we actually take those. So it's earning them and putting a deadline on how long we can earn them back is not as much an issue as if we've actually earned them, now you're not going to let us take them. And particularly not so much for our company with some income unless we have a $40 cap, but for some companies have the same problem. They don't have any production against which to use them. So they can go ahead and do everything you asked, earn those back. So there's a difference between the sunset and when you can earn them and having no sense in on when you can use them. I don't know if it helps.
No, it does help. I just worry about if we have all those credits just, gathered. I mean, I I'd like to help you solve the issue of not being able to go back and get it. I'm not sure that it doesn't involve us trying to make some kind of difference between the producers and the explorers. I mean, I think that this is another area where you guys just aren't analogous. But that whole thing of credits rolling forward and rolling forward ad infinitum really does worry me. Thank you.
Any other questions?
I have a couple. I'm just about done. I have a short sheet of things here, Mr. Chairman. You've heard earlier the point of production issue. We've raised it many times before. Essentially, we have felt that the gas treatment facility should qualify for credits. That's simply put. How you do it, moving the point of production downstream or granting credits, even though it's upstream. But essentially, it is a cost to us to have our gas and pipeline quality. We do think they should qualify for the credits if you're doing a cost-based system. And to that extent, I've had people say, well, if we're going to give you credits on your treatment facility, how about if you're going to set a tariff on that, how do you feel about that? And so I would just say that we have agreed to support the flow-through language that the Senate adopted, so that if the state essentially picks up pay for part of the treatment facility through credits, then we're not going to try and recover that cost through a tariff. So a couple things I would just say we support in both bills. The extension of the expiration incentive credits are in both bills. We would say we support that. And generally speaking, not for Anadarko, but we have a number of partners that do not have production up here. As you've heard from the Pioneer folks and things, expanding the credit monetization has been discussed, that allowing companies that don't have production to more opportunities to recover their credits without having to sell them at a discount. The state loses, if you want to call it that, or it costs the state the same amount of money, but either buying back more of those or allowing companies to utilize them to bid at lease sales and against rentals, that type of thing is a favorable thing that will not necessarily impact Anadarko because we have production, but I will say for our partners that are coming in here who do not, that is important. And that's all I had, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions of Mark? Representative Kutuba.
I have one. We've been hearing some controversy about this flow-through concept. If you get the tax credit that's related to the pipeline, the facility, or another asset that's regulated by FERC, that you flow that through. Can you think of a good reason why we wouldn't do that? Why you wouldn't do it. And we've heard protests to it, but I can't figure out why we would not do that. It just makes sense to me in terms of who's paying the costs.
I don't have an answer, Mr. Chairman.
You can't think of anything either.
Well, okay. Mr. Chairman, if I were being trapped by a lawyer. No, I don't. As I said earlier, I think we would support the concept. I mean, sure, if we could recover the costs that you put into the proposal, I think that would be. But no, I don't think. We supported that concept because we felt like if the state was going to provide us treatment facility credits and essentially help us pay for part of the cost of that, that should flow through to lower tariffs, which would actually benefit us as well as anybody else that would use the facility.
Thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. I like to ask this question once a week, and I try not to do it to the same guy or gal, but I don't think I've asked you. Looking at the family curves as they come down and take a dive below the cost of production of the hydrocarbons. What when we pass that, get below the cost on price. Let's just use oil, and we're, let's say, at $25 a barrel. Nobody would say that it's about incenting investment at that point because no one's listening. So it's about some things, but one of the things that concerns me is we were at that lower price per barrel, and we. For more of the last decade than we weren't, than we were above it.
And there are those who have, on the oil side and on our side, that say we could get there again. So at that point, it's not about incenting investment. Why wouldn't we, how could it possibly be wisdom on our part not to provide a floor? And if you bought into that for a moment, just assume you did, how would you craft that? Would it be a cents, dollars per barrel approach? Would it be ELF or PPT, whichever's greater? What would you do if you were doing it? You sat here a lot during the old oil days, and I'm just curious. Just assume you had to do it. How would you do it?
Sure. Representative Kelly, if well, here's my answer. And I'm trying to think back to when I might have sat in that chair, but I sit here now. And I would say, if you put a floor and take away the low side and start taking away the high side, it does have an impact on investment. But here, that's not an answer to your question. The answer to your question, in my mind, is let's say next year, in this environment, you're going to get an extra, just say it's $1 billion a year because prices are going to stay high. In my mind, you ought to set that $1 billion a year for that low price environment. That's how you protect yourself on the low side. Because I'll tell you, that's what a lot of the oil companies are doing right now. We went through the 80s just like everybody else did. And a lot of companies, when the price went up, started drilling like mad. And guess what happened? When the price went down, we had to lay off people. You know, it happened in Anchorage. It happened everywhere else. And what's going on this time? Drilling's going up. You see the rigs going up, but it's not spiking up. And what you found is companies are paying down debt and buying back stock. And the reason is so they can maintain a steady capital flow and keep that investment. We know there's going to be peaks and valleys. I don't know how long it's going to go down. Do we think it's going to go down to 10 and stay there? No. Could it? We're all going to be hurting if it does. But I'll tell you, the companies are saving money, essentially, in the high times to protect for the, you know, potential of that. And I would say, I would argue that taking $1 billion a year and saying you can't even touch it until, not like a CBR, but until the price gets under that $27 a barrel or something, that's your time to get through those periods. So I don't know if that's probably not exactly what you wanted to hear, but to me, I think taking some of the windfall to, you know, plan for those times when the price is down, just like a company's doing it right now, is the appropriate way to go.
You tried that latter part there, didn't you, for a while, but getting this body that behave in that fashion hasn't worked so far, so I'm just concerned about the low side. And thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Any other questions?
Did I hear something?
Well, I hear one.
The office, I think.
Well, they can buy a half a dozen.
Yeah.
Mr. Evans, thank you. And next we will go, we have Jim Weeks online. Mr. Weeks, he's a managing member of UltraStar Exploration LLC. Jim, are you with us?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am. Can you hear?
Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Okay, very good. Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, record, my name is Jim Weeks. I'm here today representing UltraStar Exploration LLC, the tiniest of the independent explorers. UltraStar was formed in 2002 by John Winther, Dale Lindsay, and me for the purpose of exploring and developing leases on the North Slope. UltraStar is 100% owned by Alaskans. I am the managing member and moved to Anchorage in 1984 with ARCO and have had a presence here ever since. Dale, who most of you know, was born and raised and still lives in Seward. John, who most of you also know, was born in Fairbanks and raised in Juneau. Currently lives in Peterson. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. During the last 2 months, I've testified and listened to a lot of testimony on the governor's original, not only to this committee, but to the other committees and thousands of the legislature. The bill seems to get more complicated with every iteration, but it is still a program we can support, given a few modest changes, and I'll go into the details of them now. The administration's original proposal was for a $73 million base allowance for net profits below which there would be no PPT with no sunset provision. The Senate, rightfully so in my mind, changed that to 5,000 barrels of oil per day, but established a sunset date of 2016, after which the allowance will expire. I question the need for a 10-year time limit after which the tax exemption will expire. Ultrastar is a small startup company that is poking around the fringes of existing units and known reservoirs. Our leases are too small to stand alone, so access to existing facilities, owned mostly by the major producers, is the only way we can develop pipeline. It took our sister company, Windstar, 6 years to negotiate access with the Park River unit to enable the drilling of the well that was completed in 2003. Ultrastar has been in negotiations with the Prudhoe Bay unit for over 3.5 years now to get seismic data and facility access to enable the drilling of our next project, our Dew Line. It takes a long time for these things to get done, and I question why our investment should be put at risk with this relatively short sunset provision, whereas current producers can use the allowance immediately after the effective date of the bill and receive the full 10 years benefit. During this debate, I've heard more than once about the need for a level playing field. No sunset provision does indeed level the playing field, or as Mark suggested, perhaps the 10-year time frame for everybody would level the field. Next is the effective date of the PPT. We agree that July 1st this year is an appropriate date, but also suggest the taxpayer should be given a 6-month grace period to come into complete compliance. Not suggesting that any taxes not be paid or be paid late, but rather that companies be allowed to get their act together within 6 months before the stiff penalties and interest provisions apply. During this period, any adjustments can be made for under and or overpayments. This bill requires a complex calculation of the appropriate amount of tax, and conforming to it will take some time, even for the current producers with tax accountants and attorneys on staff. Ultrastar hopes to have production in the future, and we will be glad to pay taxes, but we will need to contract for tax accounting and legal services on the street at market rates, and frankly, I don't know whether or not we can even find them. Anyone with hire will need to get familiar with the law and regulations and develop the algorithms needed to comply with the law. This will take some time, and I think that a 6-month grace period is the minimum amount necessary to assure compliance before penalties and interest start. Obviously, to accommodate production not yet on stream, the 6-month grace period should begin when tax is introduced, not necessarily July 1st. Lastly, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to comment on the 2020 provisions and the so-called progressivity feature of the bill and their relationship to the gas pipeline. I graduated from the University of Wyoming with a petroleum engineering degree in 1969. In the fall of 1968, nearly 40 years ago, last project, we designed a gas pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Chicago. After graduation, I joined ARCO, and in the early 70s, spent several years working in project engineering and construction based in Dallas, which was then headquarters of ARCO's North American operations. I spent hours talking to the real-life engineers and spent nights and weekends at the office sleeping on cots designing a gas pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Chicago. For 7 years in the late 80s and early 90s, I was in charge of all of ARCO's Prudhoe Bay interests, including the commercialization of natural gas. Except perhaps for Governor Hickel, I've probably worried longer than anybody in the state about getting North Slope gas to market. My nearly 40 years of involvement in this project say that it has never been this close to happening, so let's not do anything to prevent it from happening. The legislature is to be commended for the fair and full hearing given. Many thankless hours of hearings, reviewing complicated drafts, and debate by you and your colleagues in both houses, and in my mind, you all deserve a medal for your stamina. During the process, I've heard more than once that there is no linkage between PPT and the gas line project. But as the governor said this week, there is indeed linkage between the two. I think we all know that. I speak to you now as an Alaskan who hopes to build a business here that my kids and their kids can carry on. Ultrastar has zero to nothing to gain from selling any gas we might produce in conjunction with any oil we might find. Concerning me is this "so what" attitude I've heard from several legislators. They say, so what if the big guys walk from the gas line deal or discuss with the PPT? Causing them to walk from the gas line as a result of the PPT would be a huge disservice to the state of Alaska. To forego the long-term benefits of the gas line in favor of short-term higher taxes and the PPT would be a very mistaken, short-sighted approach. Therefore, I encourage you to adopt the governor's 2020 proposal, no progressivity. 20% of the net profits on $70 oil is progressive enough. Oil companies compete worldwide. Governments of China, Russia, and the Middle East don't put their domestic oil companies at a competitive disadvantage when called revenue or profit. State of Alaska. However, if you feel compelled to take a bigger share at higher prices, that bigger share should be on net profits, not gross revenue. Be careful, though, lest they walk. We're as close to a gas line project as we've ever been, and I hope that the intoxicating effects of high oil prices and additional taxes will not cause us to throw the gas baby out with the bathwater. The gas baby is our future. Enough has been enough. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Weeks, for testimony. Do we have questions for Mr. Weeks? Seeing none. That's very very compelling. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's go now to Anvil, where we have Frank Weiss.
Good afternoon, Chairman.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 305. My name is Frank Weiss. I'm the President and General Manager of Alaska Anvil Incorporated. I've listened to a number of producers today and appreciate the opportunity to testify as a consultant providing engineering design services to the petrochemical industry and the industrial needs of Alaska. Anvil's history goes way back in Alaska. Building sealift modules in our Snelson Module fabrication plant in Anacortes to the formation of a wholly owned subsidiary here in Alaska in 84, which I manage. I'll be speaking on behalf of Alaska Anvil, but I also want to reiterate that I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Alliance, which is a trade organization representing over 400 member organizations and more than 30,000 employees in Alaska, you know, to support the petroleum industry. At Alaska Anvil, we've had staff as high as 191 employees that have been supporting producers as they develop sound economic designs on the North Slope. We as Alaskans have a common desire. We want to raise our families, be successful, and take advantage of opportunities that Alaska offers to those who are willing to work hard. Working hard, however, is not enough. I believe that our state government has to ensure that we have that opportunity to work hard. And I'm looking to our state government to encourage investment in Alaska by sending a clear message that we are open for business. You know, existing industry needs to be fairly treated if they are to thrive in Alaska. They deserve to have consistent government that demonstrates fiscal responsibility and consistent taxation that doesn't change with each new administration. I'm concerned that Senate Bill 305 is out of line with that common desire. I believe that in its present form it sends a message, but it's a message that's in conflict with Alaska being open to business, a state that recognizes that increasing taxes doesn't equate to or encourage increased investment. In fact, I believe that any changes to the governor's proposal endangers investment in Alaska. At today's prices and rate of production, the governor's bill will significantly increase tax paid into the state by oil and gas producers. In principle, they have agreed to it. However, some Alaskans don't believe that's enough. And I guess my question is, what is enough? A tax rate that drives producers to investing elsewhere in the world because their tax structures are more reasonable and consistent over time than ours? I believe that every elected official in Juneau has a desire to do what they think is right, and I commend you all for your efforts in support of this. And I believe that simple economics are still the driving force behind our state's future. If we allow taxes that are unfair, inconsistent, and don't send a clear message that Alaska is a state where opportunity exists to explore, find, and develop the resources that are necessary not only to this state, but the oil and gas resources that are necessary to this nation, I believe we do a disservice. If enacted, Senate Bill 305 will leave Alaska with an even higher tax rate and cost structure than that proposed by the governor, which in its own right provides for a significant tax increase. Alaska Anvil supports the sustainable economic growth that we derive through investment in Alaska rather than a short-term windfall profit from higher taxes. With that very mindset, will in the long run drive the very industry that we are so dependent out of our state. Continue to tax them to the point where they look elsewhere. It's to our own detriment. The governor's 2020 plan is a critical hurdle for producers' confidence. If they are to commit to invest billions of dollars in a gas pipeline, we need to send them a clear message that we're consistent, that we're fair, and that we're looking for a proposition where both teams walk away from the table feeling as though they've lost something, but that they've gained a commitment and are happy to move forward. Having said all of this, on behalf of Alaska Anvil, I support the governor's bill as it was proposed and would hope that the Senate would move forward with that bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Is there any comments or any questions? Hearing none. Thank you, Frank, for your testimony. If there's no other questions that the members have thought of, if they'd like to ask any of the small producers or explorers that have been before us today, I'll call the meeting to a close. We will meet tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. to hear testimony from Dr. Pedro Van Meers and Econ One. We're still trying to contact and get a hold of Mr. Johnston and see if we can't get him here, or at least get him here by phone. We will take that up at 9 in the morning. Then we will adjourn at 11 o'clock for session, and then we'll return at 1 o'clock to take up public testimony. We will probably also hear comments from the state in regards to the final interpretation of what Senate Bill 305 and how it was changed in the other body. So with that, if there's nothing else to come before the committee, I'll bring the committee to a close. Thank you for being here. And
what time is tomorrow? 9
morning, 9 a.m. So with that, meeting's adjourned.